Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We're on the journey. There's still a lot to be done for our sisters, more in the, you know, the uneducated and those in the rural areas. And we need ourselves as women. We pull one another up. That's the message.
Uganda civil society groups call for more financial empowerment of women.
So people are very concerned about their livelihoods, and that is one area we want to assure people the only way to get into the long term is to get vaccinated. And the president made that very clear.
The Sane Institute says it will continue to encourage safe medical practices to reduce the spread of the coronavirus in Ghana.
They have a greater say in how they want their loved one to be actually buried. But we are going to ensure that we work with them, we'll keep in touch with them and ensure that even as the body is going to be repatriated back to Zambia, we are going to ensure that everything is going to be in place, just ensure that he's going to be given the fitting funeral.
And the Football Association of Zambia expresses condolences to the family of Dr. Joseph Kabungo, a CAF and FIFA medical officer. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, civil society groups are calling for more financial empowerment of women. This, the groups say, will help the country's economy to grow faster and create more jobs for the youth. The call follows a recent national dialogue on women and the Ugandan economy. Themed Break the Bias, the leaders of the group expressed concern about challenges women face in their business activities. They said, for example, that only 9% of loans are given to businesswomen, which they said undermines efforts to help boost women entrepreneurs. Maggie Kigozi, a medical doctor, business consultant, and educator, was a keynote speaker at the conference. She tells me that Uganda cannot discuss the state of the economy without the voice of women.
Yes, the meeting was organized by the ladies in the civil society, and they've done a lot of advocacy for all kinds of women's rights. But I think they've now come around to think, you know, economic empowerment is equally important. You may have all the rights, but if you have no money at all, it is not very useful, and you certainly not, they'll not be accorded to you. I was sharing what the private sector is doing, the women in the private sector, and the possibilities for all other women.
You said you cannot discuss the state of the economy without the voice of women. What do you mean by that?
I meant that women contribute immensely. 39% of all farms in Uganda are owned by women. And when it comes to agriculture, it is over 70%, especially smallholder agriculture. But we've moved into commercial agriculture as well. So for them to be discussing it and not having that on the table does not make sense. We know what will make us succeed and how to get it done. So yes, we must be at the table to fight for what we need.
So what do you think can be done by both government and private institutions or the private sector to help encourage women to be more participatory and for their efforts to be recognized?
Well, when we ask the women themselves, one of the issues is information, knowledge, education. They traditionally were left out of education, so the older generation may even be illiterate. Yes, we now have universal primary and secondary education, so many of us are at school now, but a lot of our older people missed out. And even the younger ones are dropping out. They marry them off at 14, 15, you know, they get pregnant. This happened a lot during COVID. So those ones need some, you know, skilling, some training, and even just information. Often they don't know what's happening in the country. They're too busy. Women are always working. They are looking after babies. They're fetching the water. So they don't hear the news and, you know, that kind of thing. So they need information. They need skilling. They need training. They also need access to finance. The other one is access to land. Land in my country traditionally is given to the men. And the girls do not inherit because they'll go away and get married to someone else. Yeah, so the access to land for agriculture and also to be used as collateral in the bank when, for your business. Women were not getting access to that. But again, I must say, we now, our fathers are better educated than they do leave us land. So that is changing as well.
Dr. Kigozi, recently when I was in Uganda, I had the opportunity of going to some places where women are being trained. I think it's a presidential or government initiative. Does that mean that such skill impacting groups or initiatives have to be replicated across country to encourage women to fully participate in the economy?
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody who needs skilling, those who dropped out of, the ones who are in school should go all the way to university. We would like to see our, you know, in science, in engineering, and yeah, we're seeing that happen. But now those who didn't get that opportunity, the kind of skilling that you saw is what we need. You know, they can do small things and they don't take very long and they don't take too much time. So they can do like tailoring, they can do hairdressing. Then we are trying to say women can do anything. So yes, they can do engineering. They don't.
What is your message to women in Uganda concerning their role in the Ugandan economy?
Yes, to the women in Uganda, we have made progress. We are moving on. But in the end, it is up to you. What do you want to do? I want to motivate you. Yes, you can. The other message I was sharing is that the women who, with whom we address those issues that I gave you earlier are doing very well. They have large businesses and they're growing. There are women in manufacturing, there are women in agriculture, there are women in tourism, with big hotels, you know. So, yes, we're on the journey. There's still a lot to be done for our sisters, more in the, you know, the uneducated and those in the rural areas. And we need ourselves, as women, we pull one another up. That's the message.
Maggie Kigozi is a medical doctor, business consultant, and educator. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Ghana, the Sane Institute says it's committed to its campaign to encourage safe medical practices to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. The Sane Institute focuses on nurturing interfaith and interdisciplinary research for improved healthcare and well-being. The organization says although the infection rate has decreased, people should continue to observe social distancing, frequent hand washing, and other measures to keep their families safe. The comment came after the government announced it was easing COVID-19 medical measures. This after ending the mandatory public mask wearing and opening the country's borders with neighboring countries. Professor John Azuma is the executive director of the Sane Institute. He tells me that Ghanaians need to keep observing the COVID protocols even though the infection rate has sharply decreased.
We do have a number of initiatives that mainly is aimed at sensitizing, educating Ghanaians, as we said, in churches mainly, but also in mosques amongst religious faithful, especially when the pandemic broke out. In 2020, we suddenly realized that there was a lot of misconceptions and misinformation and a lot of conspiracy. And we thought that was going to be harmful. So we trained a number of young people, and their duty was to take this message, take this pandemic seriously, to take that message into the churches and into the mosques. But also targeting religious leaders with these kinds of messaging.
When you encourage some of these religious leaders to take pictures and put it on social media, what was the reaction?
I took the first vaccine when it came, and I took a photograph of mine and receiving the vaccine and put it on my church, my own local church platform, social WhatsApp platform. And there was a lot of reaction, some were skeptical, and some kept saying, look, if Professor Azuma has taken this, it means it is safe, and I'm going to take it. Some said, well, let's wait 2 weeks and see what happens to Professor Azuma, and we will take it. And soon after that, a lot of people, almost everyone in my church, was vaccinated, because all the excuses and the fear started going away, and people were more confident to take it.
The president has recently come out to relax some of the COVID-19 measures, including the wearing of masks. Face mask is no longer mandatory. The borders have been opened. People are worried and expressing concern that people might be laxed, although the coronavirus still remains.
Yes, that is a concern, definitely. Especially the fact that the vaccination rates are still very low. Even though the vaccines are now readily available, a lot of the rural areas, they don't even know where to go for the vaccine because it's in the city, and very much so. And so there has been also this perception that this disease is not something that is meant for the rural, far-flung areas of the country. And yet we know that is all not true. So these are the problems we're facing, that with this kind of relaxation, even those who did not take it seriously from the beginning are going to use this as an excuse. But I have to say that a lot of the educated class are taking the mask very seriously, and they were wearing their mask not because of what the president said, but because they followed the science, and they are going to keep wearing the mask. So the president says it's no longer mandatory, it's no longer required. But I'm very, very sure. I was driving here this morning, and I still saw a number of people still wearing their mask. And that's going to continue.
So where do you go from here, especially when things appear to be a little bit more relaxed because the infection rate has significantly subsided in parts of the country? Where does your group go from here?
Well, our main focus is going to be really on education for the vaccine, for people to get vaccinated. That we believe is very much part of the reason why we are where we are today, that things are getting better around the world, including Ghana. And we just need to make sure that we get that message across. The vaccines are safe, the vaccines are effective, and the vaccines will make this a long-term solution. Because if we don't get vaccinated, and people stop wearing the mask, we are going to go back to where we were in 2020, and nobody wants to go back there. One of the things that has affected Ghanaians a lot with the COVID-19, the pandemic, is not just the health risk, but the economic downturn. And a lot of people have been impacted. And so people are very concerned about their livelihoods, and that is one area we want to assure people the only way to get into the long term is to get vaccinated. And the president made that very clear.
Professor John Azuma is the executive director of the Sani Institute. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The Football Association of Zambia has expressed condolences to the family of Dr. Joseph Kabungo, who recently died in Nigeria on official duty with the Confederation of African Football, or CAF. Dr. Kabungo was the CAF FIFA medical officer who was on duty as a doping officer in last Tuesday's soccer match between Nigeria and Ghana. He reportedly died of a heart attack after the game. Kabungo was a team doctor for the Zambia national team, the Chipolopolo Boys, when they won the 2012 African Nations Cup in Gabon. The Football Association of Zambia says it is waiting for the official report after an investigation into the death of the CAF FIFA medical officer. For more reaction to the death of Dr. Kabungo, I reached Sydney Mungala, spokesperson for the Football Association of Zambia.
We are all very shocked. It is something that happened out of nowhere. Remember, this was just a routine match, the final leg qualifier for the World Cup between Nigeria and Ghana. So he was just assigned a routine role as a CAF medical officer for that particular game. And obviously, the expectation was that this was just one of the usual activities that doctors go through at football matches. So we were very shocked initially when we learned that there was someone who had died unofficial, because initially there was no name attached to the death when the report
started filtering through. Sadly, we were notified by CAF and also the host nation that the person who had died has been identified as Zambian and is a medical doctor. So from that perspective, we are still very shocked. We've been made aware that the cause of death has been identified as a cardiac arrest in the aftermath of that game that ended the 1-1. Gifting Ghana qualification to the World Cup.
Has the Football Association of Zambia extended your condolences to the family of Dr. Kabungo, especially since he played a key role in Zambian football?
Yes, the first president himself, Mr. Andrew Kamanga, was among the earliest people to announce to the nation that the death had been confirmed. And also he has extended his condolences to the family of Dr. Kabungo and also the football family, because Dr. Kabungo also served in FAS as a national team doctor for many years. He was part of the team that won the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations. He was a team doctor. And after that, he was elevated to being a CAF medical officer. He was involved in various CAF games, including continental competitions. Even the last Africa Cup of Nations final between Senegal and Egypt, he was the COVID medical officer assigned for that responsibility. He was also recent in Qatar for the FIFA Arab Cup, which is a precursor for the FIFA World Cup. So he has always been involved in these football activities. And also, he has been actually part of the officials that were being identified to be part of the FIFA World Cup. So he has been a role model to many upcoming football administrators and also medics in the game. And we are very saddened that he had to go at a time that many people have been looking up to him to provide an outstanding example for would-be doctors or many other people involved in the game.
Sydney, any role that FAS or Football Association of Zambia will play in the ceremony that will lead to his burial?
Obviously, at every stage we are being involved. Remember, he was on duty at CAF. Obviously, the recommendation always comes from the host, from the mother board, which is FAS. So even when he's been assigned these responsibilities by CAF or FIFA, they've always come through the association. So even the process of repatriation of his body, of course, we work with the government. He was a Zambian citizen who was on duty outside our borders. Obviously, government to play a role. But obviously, in terms of the football protocols and also acknowledging his contribution to the game, we are going to be involved at every stage. And we hope that we can give him a befitting send-off, because he did so much for the game, and we can only celebrate his life by giving him a befitting send-off. Yes, of course, remember, like I said, he was on duty on the recommendation of the association. So at every stage, we have to ensure that everything that needs to be done is done. We will work with different people, government, and also obviously the family. They have a greater say in how they want their loved one to be actually buried. But we are going to ensure that we work with them, we'll keep in touch with them and ensure that even as the body is going to be repatriated back to Zambia, we are going to ensure that everything is going to be in place, just ensure that he's going to be given a befitting send-off.
Sydney Mungala is spokesperson for the Football Association of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A senior UN official warned South Sudan is facing its worst humanitarian crisis since the country became independent in July 2011. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The celebrations that greeted that joyful event and the hopes that were raised for a peaceful, more prosperous future have been dashed. More than a decade after South Sudan gained its independence, the country remains riven in conflict, crushed by multiple natural and man-made disasters, and unable to feed its population. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Sarah Besolo Nianti, says the number of people struggling to eke out a living keeps rising year after year. She says year after year, more people are plunged into extreme poverty and desperation. She says the appalling situation cannot go on. Something must change.
As much as we need $1.7 billion this year for humanitarian needs, we also need funding for development and for peace building, ensuring social cohesion and resilience. Humanitarian aid will not solve the problems of the people of South Sudan. We need to make sure we protect and support those who are most vulnerable, But at the same time, where possible, we need to start now to build capacity.
Nianti says it is important to empower those who can feed themselves. She does, however, acknowledge the primary need to provide food to some 8.3 million people suffering from acute hunger. She says aid also must be given to millions of people who have no access to safe drinking water and sanitation or to medical care. She says it is crucial to provide protection and psychosocial treatment to vulnerable people who are victims of violence, human rights violations, and gender-based sexual violence, including rape. While the emergency needs remain a priority, she says donors also should invest in development projects in relatively stable areas of South Sudan, which could benefit from such support.
We're talking about a humanitarian operation that will be structured in a way to increase the dignity that the people of South Sudan deserve. And that dignity will come with empowerment. It will come with us doing things differently, looking across humanitarian development and peace. Humanitarian response is necessary now to save lives. A development response is necessary to preserve the future.
Humanitarian coordinator Nianti says investing in development in South Sudan and shoring up people's ability to become self-sufficient will loosen the country's dependency on international aid. She says the benefits of helping people to help themselves are undeniable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, says as the COVID-19 pandemic enters its third year, 23 countries home to around 405 million schoolchildren have yet to fully open schools, with many children at risk of dropping out. For VOA, Mavis Ochery in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
UNICEF's latest report shows that in Liberia, 43% of students did not return when public schools reopened in December 2020. The number of out-of-school children in South Africa tripled from 250,000 to 750,000 between March 2020 and July 2021. Licky van der Wol is the UNICEF Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa based in Nairobi, Kenya. She says the situation in that region was better than in other parts of the world as many countries reopened schools in mid-2021. Uganda was the last to reopen with classes resuming at the start of this year. However, in Mozambique, children are in class only 3 hours a day because some teachers have not yet returned to work. She says education risks becoming the greatest divider in terms of development as the COVID-19 pandemic enters its third year. Van der Wol says in the past 2 years, around 50% of children in the region were not up to grade levels in terms of reading and writing at the age of 10.
Well, there's different levels of impact. What we've seen now, 2 years in, is that actually there's a huge learning loss. Learning loss means that children are supposed to reach certain milestones in reading and writing and numeracy, and that they don't meet those milestones because they just have not been able to go to school sufficiently. And if they were in school, they didn't learn enough.
Even where schools have reopened, many students have not returned. Instead, they are working to help their families. She says around 30 million children have not gone back to class in Eastern and Southern Africa. Van der Wol says even before the pandemic, 37 million children in the region were already out of school.
For the children themselves, it poses a big risk of being out of school, not learning, which is a right for them. But it also means that they have a less protection in their daily lives. Normally, a school and the rhythm of school, going to school, making friends, being protected by the teachers, does have a protective impact on the lives of children. If the children are not going back to school, it means that they have to work odd jobs or they have informal work. And very often their exposure to violence and unwanted behavior.
She says around the world, as much as $17 trillion was lost in economic growth because of school closures. She says school closures should not be an option in surges of COVID-19 pandemic.
That at this stage, the children should not suffer by closing schools, even if there would be another wave. We have seen that schools in themselves are not necessarily more contagious for children, not more than the community. So basically, there's no reason to close the schools, even if there is a particular wave in a particular community.
She says UNICEF and its partners are working with governments to safely get children back in class. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Sotri in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, scientists in Kenya are testing the region's first project using solar panels to shade crops while generating clean energy known as agrivoltaics. Trials of the technology have shown that growing crops under solar panels reduces water loss and results in high yields in areas prone to drought. For VOA, Juma Majanga reports from Kajiado, Kenya.
Under Kenya's scorching sun and clear skies, about 60 kilometers south of Nairobi, Anne Watkins, a local farmer in Kajiado County, is learning a new technology called agrivoltaic.
If the white fries are also called mingi sana.
The technique involves using solar panels to shed crops, harvest rainwater, and generate clean energy.
This is a new technology which saves on so much, and with the climate change, and especially with the solar production, I think with the solar it's free. We have to maximize to save again on climate change, and basically to save on costs, especially those in those arid and semi-arid areas.
The agrivoltaic system has been used successfully in Western countries like the United States and Germany, but this is the first such project in Africa. Year-long research with scientists from the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom, Wild Agroforestry and Kajiado-based Latia Agropreneurship Institute has yielded positive results for the project dubbed Harvesting the Sun Twice.
We had two plots. We have the control plot that is grown under the normal conditions. And what we were able to know is that after the analysis, we were able to get that the crops that were grown under the panels performed better. That is in terms of the quantity and the quality.
According to World Bank data, more than half of Africa's population did not have access to electricity by 2019. Agrivoltaic technology combines land dedicated to solar panels with land dedicated to agriculture to improve food security and grid connectivity.
Over the last 15 years, over the last 20 to 30 years, all the players that have been in the agriculture ecosystem, we have put the foundations for why agribusiness is viable for the continent. Most of the technologies that we are talking about, we know which technologies have a chance of success on the continent. What really now needs to be done is to connect the dots.
After the successful rollout in Kenya, another trial is being set up in the neighboring Tanzania, the aim being to spread the technology across the continent. But farmers like Anne Watkins say they need help.
Being a capital-intensive project, the government maybe can put up policies in place when it comes to funding, maybe providing cheaper loans to farmers, and maybe organizing farmers into cooperatives, which may end up being a community project, is a cooperative.
While adaptation of climate-smart technologies like agrivoltaic offers hope to farmers in the face of a changing climate, the challenge remains in the rollout to farmers in rural Africa who need such technologies the most. Juma Majanga for VA News, Kajiado, Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Like Muslims across the world, Egyptians welcome the month of Ramadan as a special time of prayers, charity, and family gathering. But with the devaluation of the Egyptian currency and higher food prices, Egyptians are facing a tough Ramadan this year. For VOA, Angie Omar reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Ramadan in Egypt usually is a festive month, with a special Ramadan decorations, night prayers, charity tables for the poor to break their fast, and iftar dinners for family and friends. This year, Egyptians' expectations for the fasting months are gloomy. Ramadan, which begins Saturday in most of the world, this year falls at a time of soaring food prices. Many of Egypt's 102 million people expect the surge in prices to force them to consume considerably less when they gather to break their dawn-to-dusk fast with the traditional sunset meal. High on the list of items typically consumed during Ramadan are red meat, chicken, desserts such as baklava and dried fruits, and nuts and juices. This year, fewer Egyptians are likely to be able to afford them. A kilogram of beef or mutton, for example, can cost more than 180 Egyptian pounds, or $9.75. Fatima Morsi is the mother of four children. She says that now 1 kilogram of meat costs 200 pounds. So what shall they eat? Chicken? 1 kilogram of chicken costs 45 pounds. Even vegetables have become expensive. And she asks, if the price of bread rose because the Ukraine war caused a spike in wheat prices, how about vegetables? Do you import vegetables too? Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly acknowledged the present crisis is worse than that of the coronavirus, and food prices are going up. He announced a multi-billion dollar relief package to ease the hardships Egypt's most vulnerable are facing. The government has expanded its routine Ramadan campaign to provide packages of essential foods to the most vulnerable. 15,000 outlets across the country have been set up to sell goods at discounted prices. But even for the middle class, the prices of some of these items are daunting in a country where most university graduates consider themselves lucky if they land an entry-level job that pays about $200 a month. Saleh Ahmed is a university graduate, but he has a message for the Egyptian president as Ramadan is starting.
هل سيادة الرئيس يعرف ان اكلة الكشري اللي هو العادي ده اللي هو رز وعدس اصفر؟
He asks, does the president realize that a simple dinner of rice and lentils with potatoes, eggs and salad could cost his family 100 Egyptian pounds? Inflation has burned us. People cannot take it anymore. Over the past 4 weeks, average food prices in Egypt have risen by at least 20%. Recently on state-owned television, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi offered a suggestion on countering inflation. The president asks, would you like to control food prices? Yes? Then it's simple. Any food item getting expensive, don't buy it. A sharp drop in the value of the Egyptian pound against the US dollar will almost certainly trigger another wave of price increases on a wide range of goods and services, and make this Ramadan a less joyful month for most Egyptians. Angie Almer for VOA News, Cairo.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The draw for the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 is done. Africa's five representatives were handed tricky groups at the tournament. In Friday's draw, Tunisia were paired with defending champions France, and Cameroon were put into the same group as five-time winners Brazil. Africa Cup of Nations holders Senegal will take on host Qatar, and Morocco are in the same group as Belgium, who are second in the world rankings. Ghana are in Group H, where the Black Stars will face Uruguay, Portugal, and South Korea. Ghana were eliminated by Uruguay on penalties in South Africa, having seen Asamoah Gyan miss an extra time spot kick after Luis Suarez was sent off for handball. Only three sides from Africa have ever progressed to the quarterfinals. That is Cameroon in 1990, Senegal in 2002, and Ghana in 2010. In the CAF Champions League, South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns completed their group phase campaign in style, thrashing Almeric 3-0 at home on Saturday. Sundowns, who were already qualified for the quarterfinals, were looking to end the group stage strong, and they did. They now sit top of Group A with 16 points out of a possible 18, while Merrick suffered their fourth loss in a row to finish bottom with just 4 points. Sundowns now await to know their quarterfinal opponents when the draw is conducted in Cairo on April 5th. In athletics, Kenya's Kenneth Renju and Nesfine Jepleting battled their rivals and the cold conditions to triumph at the Sportsimo Prague Half Marathon, a World Athletics Elite Label Road Race on Saturday. The event returned for the first time since 2019. Securing the first half marathon wins of their careers, Renju ran 59 minutes and 28 seconds for victory ahead of his compatriots Philemon Kiplimo and Matthew Kimeli, while Jepleting clocked a personal best of 1 hour 6 minutes and 57 seconds to claim the women's title ahead of her fellow Kenyans Irene Cheptai and Brenda Jepleting. And that's about it for this edition of Northern Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, President of Kenya announced that the East African community had agreed to accept the application of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, to become a member. Obviously, there was much study and thinking by the community to accept that application. The new 7-member East African community will present a golden opportunity to that community and may be a model for the African continent itself. It will stretch from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic. It will comprise various ethnic groups, 3 or 4 Anglo-Saxon countries and 3 Francophone countries with enormous wealth and technical possibilities. But the first thing that the new community should do after all legal plans have been completed is to tackle a number of points. 1, the community must make strenuous efforts to end the bickering amongst some of its constituent parts. We all know the accusations which have been flown back and forth between some members of the East African community as to who is interfering in the internal affairs of their country and also of the eastern part of the DRC. It is also important to point out that much of the eastern side of the DRC has common similarities with the other existing 6 members. Same language, many tribal similarities. Second thing that the authorities should try to do is to end the profound insecurity that now exists in eastern DRC. The M13 rebels are again causing enormous damage to the detriment of the people of eastern DRC. Again, there are accusations that some component parts of the East African community may be involved in stoking that problem. And in this connection, the authority, the community may want to examine how best to provide security for the community itself, looking carefully as to whether they still would want the United Nations peacekeeping forces to remain within the community. And in this connection, they may want to study carefully an idea that was once proposed in Europe in 1950 of the creation of a European Defense Commission to incorporate the just defeated German nation. That idea was welcomed by many states in Europe, but unfortunately, the French Assembly in 1954 killed the idea. But it was one that was good, so I think the authority may want to go back to and look at it and see whether that could be applied to provide security for the new enhanced community. Another point which may be worthy of consideration by the community is the enormous resources that is now available to the enhanced community, particularly the mineral resources that are in the DRC, which are the envy of the international community. For example, we know that cobalt and lithium, two crucial commodities which are necessary for electricals, are there. And also, we should know that there are intense competition for non-African third parties to get their hands on those commodities. One way to look at it is, again, another plan that was once considered and applied in Europe in the 1950s, which was the foundation of the current European Union, which is now a formidable trading partner. That was the so-called Schuman Plan, which placed coal and steel under one European authority. May not this be an example, for example, to look at whether certain critical industries in the new community could be placed under one or two authorities so that it could be better exploited and advanced. This is why most Africans should embrace this new development. It must be recalled that when the DRC, then the Congo Republic, became independent, again, there was great competition by non-African third parties to balkanize the states. Fortunately, with the help of the United Nations Peacekeeping Force, the DRC remained unified. So this is some of the things which the new community may look at to ensure that it may be a model that the African should look at to make the continent a stronger trading partner, stronger economic region, so that it could no longer be disregarded as it is today. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Kuropokwa. bila kugombana. Mapenzi yako ya kibabe sana, malumbano ya mapenzi siyawezi. Kuna muda sielewi mana, hivi kunini kwako nangangana. Mapenzi gani haya kute sana, wasi wasi wa mapenzi. Hivi kunini we isia zangu unazikondesha, nani wekara wajuu.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Mohamed El Shenawi and producer Said Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a bald-headed man will not grow hair by getting excited. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.